The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're already at Friday, the last show of the week. Lots to get to before we conclude this week right here on KPCG and kpcg.fm if you're listening online. Friday, of course, means that we have the Trumpet Hour Week in Review later on today, so make sure that you tune in, whatever the time may be, wherever you happen to live. And listen to the round table as they summarize the most important events from the week. On today's Trumpet Daily Radio Show, we're going to be looking at a few stories that caught our attention. In the second segment, there's this column by Peggy Noonan as she looks back 20 years on from the President Clinton scandal from 1998. And she weighs in on just how much of an impact that had on America's morals. And if you remember, some of you long-timers will remember that following all of those scandals in the late 1990s, we came out with a little booklet called Character in Crisis. And, of course, we wrote that 20 years ago. And you'll see how it aligns, I think, pretty good with Noonan's perspective 20 years on. We'll tie that in with another one by... Well, I don't know who it's by. It's at Investor's Business Daily, but it's about the life expectancy decline and what it means for young Americans in particular. The life expectancy decline in the United States. So that's coming up in the next segment, and then at the end, hopefully, we can finish on an especially positive note with more content, more material on the subject of God's love. A subject that we got into, I believe, on Tuesday's program, maybe, or Monday. I can't remember exactly. But we'll continue that toward the very end of today's show. To begin with, I guess I have to address the latest game changer, yet another game changer, yet another bombshell report. This report about the Mueller prosecutors flipping Michael Cohen, who used to be the lawyer for President Trump. He's now admitting to a lie that he gave before Congress, a lie about a potential real estate deal between Donald Trump, who, in case you didn't know, he was into real estate before he became president of the United States. He was a real estate mogul who had properties all over the world. And evidently, he was looking into the prospects of building one of his hotels or a building of his in Moscow. And according to all the reports that you saw yesterday, the alarming reports, I might add, Cohen said in his testimony before Congress that they had given up on that plan or that idea and had stopped talking about it in January of 2016, right when the campaigning for president was just about to get into full swing. In fact, they didn't stop talking about this possibility until June of 2016. So that was the lie. That's what got Cohen to flip. Of course, he had some other crimes that he committed all of his own with taxes, mortgages, or whatever. And President Trump addressed that yesterday briefly when he spoke to reporters. I'll play that for you in just a minute. But this is the game changer. This is the bombshell. The fact that he might have wanted to build one of his buildings, his properties in Moscow. And as BuzzFeed noted, this is very important. The skyscraper that he planned to build, he was going to reserve a penthouse for Vladimir Putin. A building that might have been built with a penthouse that might have been for Vladimir Putin. And this, I guess we're supposed to believe, this proves that there was Russian collusion or that the Trump administration colluded with Russia to cheat Hillary Clinton out of a sure victory in that November election in 2016. Listen to President Trump yesterday. This is clip two.
Michael Cohen, what he's doing is he was convicted, I guess. You'll have to put it into legal terms. But he was convicted with a fairly long-term sentence on things totally unrelated to the Trump Organization, having to do with mortgages and having to do with cheating the IRS, perhaps, a lot of different things. I don't know exactly, but he was convicted of various things unrelated to us. He was given a fairly long jail sentence, and he's a weak person. And by being weak, unlike other people that you watch, he's a weak person, and what he's trying to do is get a reduced sentence.
He's trying to get a reduced sentence, and of course what the prosecutors are trying to do is get him to flip so that they can use him against Donald Trump. They offer incentives. This is legal for prosecutors to do this. They offer incentives to witnesses, bribes in other words, so that they can flip them over. He used to be the lawyer for Donald Trump. If you go back to some of the scandals that were covered up by the media involving Hillary Clinton, her lawyers were untouchable. Those communications between her lawyers and Hillary Clinton, they were kept completely private. Never mind what happened. Never mind what went on. Confidentiality. Attorney-client privilege. You haven't heard much of that with respect to the so-called bombshell from yesterday. Hillary Clinton had lawyers that were lying to FBI agents. And yet, they were given a pass. They're given immunity. They're given this. They're given that. And here comes Michael Cohen, who is trying to reduce his sentence, as the president brings out yesterday. And the media, they're hyperventilating because, well, this is the worst day of his presidency. He should resign today. Surely this leads to impeachment. Listen to the president as he talks about what he was doing as a practical matter, what his profession was before he ever decided to run for president. This is clip three.
So he's lying about a project that everybody knew about. I mean, we were very open with it. We were thinking about building a building. I guess we had in a form. It was an option. I don't know what you'd call it. I decided ultimately not to do it. There would have been nothing wrong if I did do it. If I did do it, there would have been nothing wrong. That was my business. So he's lying very simply to get a reduced sentence, okay?
That's President Trump yesterday responding to the latest bombshell, the latest game changer. He's saying he's lying. And, by the way, I was a real estate mogul. I thought about doing this job, decided against it. Even if I would have gone forward with it, nothing illegal. Nothing illegal about that. He has, as I say, he has properties all over the world. I loved his tweet from earlier this morning. He said, oh, I get it. I'm a very good developer, happily living my life when I see our country going in the wrong direction, to put it mildly. Against all odds, I decide to run for president and continue to run my business. Very legal, very cool, he said. Talked about it on the campaign trail, lightly looked at doing a building somewhere in Russia, put up zero money, zero guarantees, and didn't do the project. It's a witch hunt, he says. This is a witch hunt. Or as my father said earlier this year, it's a hoax. It's a complete hoax. The bloggers over at Powerline, they said, thanks to the work of Representative Devin Nunes, we know of actual collusion by a presidential campaign with organs of Russian intelligence. I refer to the Clinton campaign's work with the friends of Vladimir Putin via the Perkins Coie, Glenn Simpson, Fusion GPS, and Christopher Steele. It's on the face of the Steele dossier. It's all there. The trail is there. The dots are there to be connected. Russian collusion. The Clinton campaign working with Russia. Russian officials. He says here, if one seeks false statements to Congress that bear on Russian interference and campaign collusion, look no further than Glenn Simpson's testimony to the Congressional Intelligence Committees. And then he talks about what they wrote about that previously. A serious prosecutor, he writes, might also make something of the incredible governmental wrongdoing at the heart of the investigation that gave rise to the Mueller probe. It's the biggest political scandal in our history, and Donald Trump is a victim of it, not a perpetrator. He's the victim here. All that they have, perjury traps, trying to catch people after the fact. After the fact, as Alan Dershowitz explained on Fox, just step back for a moment and look at the big picture of how this investigation, this special counsel, of how it's all unfolded over the past year and a half. This first one here is from Dershowitz, I believe, not yesterday, maybe the day before, on Fox News, clip one.
Almost all the indictments secured by Mueller have either been indictments of people lying, that is, for committing crimes that didn't occur before he was appointed, but occurred as the result of his being appointed, or finding financial misconduct by people that are unrelated to the president or unrelated to the Russia probes. This new development with Cohen suggests that they're going to go after political issues, not just criminal issues.
And that's what they're doing. They're criminalizing politics that they don't like. That's why everyone on the one side, the Hillary Clinton camp, they can do whatever with impunity. There's no penalties. They're not held, their feet aren't held to the fire when they lie before Congress or in front of FBI agents. And as for obstructing justice, well, I don't need to get into all of the things that have happened before, but here's Dershowitz again last night on Fox News making some of the same points. But listen again, clip four.
If you offered a bribe, you go to jail. But if a prosecutor offers a bribe, it's regarded as good conduct. It shouldn't be legal. Tragically, it is. But what we're seeing now is case after case being built against people simply for lying. These are not crimes that occurred before the special prosecutor came to office. He's supposed to have uncovered crimes that had occurred in the past. Instead, he's facilitating and incentivizing the crimes by creating these perjury traps. Virtually all of his indictments and pleas come from people who he got to lie in front of investigators by setting perjury traps for them.
You just look at the timing of it all. The investigation originally, remember, it's supposed to look into the so-called collusion, tampering with those election results from 2016. But all that they've gotten is what they've gotten from setting perjury traps, just like the professor says there, Dershowitz, who's an attorney as well. They've incentivized these crimes by creating the perjury traps. It says here at The Hill, federal agents have reportedly raided the Chicago City Hall office of a lawyer who previously did tax work for President Trump. So it's nonstop. It's like my father said in that that excellent article that we've referred to dozens of times, corrupt law enforcement officials. They're in place. They were there when Barack Obama was there. They conspired before President Trump was even elected. They were conspiring to overthrow the government. Everything was going according to plan. Hillary Clinton was supposed to be the anointed successor. Well, Donald Trump disrupted that in a massive kind of way. And now what we're seeing is not evidence piling up that proves he's guilty. What we're seeing, like my father said in that article from April or May, is all of this corruption on a deep level, deep within the deep state. So much so, so deep, as he said in May. It's hard to believe, but we're seeing just how desperate they are to seize power. You know, a point my father makes in that article is think about what would happen or what would have happened had Hillary Clinton been elected. We wouldn't know about any of this. And think about what would be going on behind the scenes. As it is, a fair bit of it's been flushed out into the open, and it is appalling to see it on display. Here they flip Cohen. Now they're raiding the offices of someone who used to do tax work for President Trump. according to the left, the radical left-wing constitution, their constitution says that he has to turn over his tax returns. He can't touch Bob Mueller. His lawyers can't talk to Paul Manafort's lawyers. They have their rules, their system. And it's lawlessness through and through. The Chicago Sun-Times reports that federal agents removed everyone from the office of Chicago Finance Committee Chairman Ed Burke. He's the one that used to work on President Trump's taxes. They removed everyone out of their offices, covering the floor to ceiling windows with brown paper, covering up the windows with brown paper as they go about rummaging through the offices. That's in Chicago. Then there's another report here from the Daily Caller. FBI raids home of whistleblower on the Clinton Foundation. That's the foundation that brought in hundreds of millions of dollars for Bill and Hillary Clinton following Bill Clinton's presidency in the 1990s. A presidency rife with scandal, as we'll cover in the next segment. Here's this whistleblower talking about all of these back channel dealings, these shady room dealings that allowed for the Clintons to make a fortune. The Daily Caller says the FBI raided the home of a whistleblower who was in possession of documents regarding the Clinton Foundation and Uranium One. It says the whistleblower, Dennis Nathan Cain, had turned the documents over to the Department of Justice's Inspector General and both the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, according to his lawyer. The FBI rummaged through Cain's home for 6 hours, even after the whistleblower handed over documents, according to his attorney. He hands over the documents, but that's not enough for these investigators, these FBI agents. They've got to go in and raid the home. When is this going to stop? Well, this is just a preview, because come January, the Democrats will have a majority in the House of Representatives. This is only the beginning, the investigations. It gives us a bit of a preview of what's going to be happening at length in the next 2 years. Go back, if you haven't read it, and you've probably read it because we've referred to it so many times, go back to that May issue of the Trumpet magazine, Saving America from the Radical Left Temporarily. There's really only one. There's a few others that are fighting against it, but really there's one individual who's standing up to it all, and seeing him fight at times, it is something to behold. That individual is the president of the United States. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
A turning point in recent history has gone almost entirely overlooked. Since that time, an unseen cause has brought about national and world troubles in unprecedented fashion. Crises are intensifying as never before. In our generation, we are seeing radical changes to culture, family, education, religion, science, finance, politics, international relations. Everything has been affected. You cannot understand events without recognizing this unseen cause. The United States has been shaken in astonishing fashion. Have you wondered why the world's number one superpower is declining so rapidly? Are you concerned about where the current administration is leading this country? The Bible provides penetrating insight into the invisible cause of society's decline. America is prophesied to fall before it rises again. The Bible also gives extraordinary insight into how that fall will come about. This insight puts the seriousness and urgency of current events in their true perspective. Understand what's in store for America and why. Visit thetrumpet.com and click on the literature tab to request this free, enlightening booklet, America Under Attack.
From from the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England. This is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Flurry.
We're nearly done with the book that we're going through with our book club here at Edstone, John McCullough's, or is that his name, John McCullough? No. David McCullough, there we go. David McCullough's book about John Adams. There, I've got a little bit of dyslexia here. It's the last show of the week, so bear with me. But we're about three chapters to go before we get to the conclusion of that book. Where we are right now, he's in the midst of his presidency, John Adams, his most difficult year there back in 1798. We had just passed through with some of our recent reading the end of George Washington's presidency and the comments there in the book, the biography about his farewell address, and just how that very quickly became a classic in America's founding documents. And it's astounding, really, when you think about not just John Adams, but the first president, too, Washington and Adams, both two presidents who put so much emphasis on religion and morality, character, the character of a leader. So important, these founders said, so important, critical to the success, not just of their leadership, but to the success of the country. Peggy Noonan, as I mentioned at the top of the show, she had a column just recently, her reflections on the scandals of the late 1990s and the impeachment of Bill Clinton that happened in 1998. She talked in her column about how that when it first started to become known, some of the details of this salacious story, she couldn't believe it. She started hearing all these details and reading it in the newspapers. Noonan says, I see it all now more as a tragedy than a scandal. I'm more convinced than ever that Mr. Clinton made the epic political miscalculation of the 20th century's latter half. He had two choices when news of the affair was uncovered. Tell the truth and pay the price, or lie and hope to get away with it. If he told the truth, even accompanied by a moving public apology, the toll would have been enormous. I mean, he would have had to recover politically, but she says here that he probably would have, and then the country could have moved on. As it is, they lied and lied and lied until they absolutely couldn't do it anymore. Noonan says, much more important, here is why it's a tragedy. It wouldn't have dragged America through the mud. It only would have dragged him through the mud. As it was, the whole nation had to go through what she calls a cultural catastrophe. And then listen to this, and you see how relevant it is to our day. It marked the end of a certain mystique of leadership, and it damaged the mystique of American democracy. All of America's airwaves were full of the sludge. The scandal lowered everything. So the media, they had their part in it as well. But you look back on it, what a tragedy, what a scandal, and all of that sludge. It was a tragedy because in lying and trying to protect himself, Mr. Clinton was deciding not to protect America. And that is the unforgivable sin, that he put America through that, not what happened to Monica Lewinsky or with Monica Lewinsky. So it's interesting, as I say, you look at all of the lies and the scandal, the deep state. It's not to say that the current president is perfect. Far from it. I think if Washington or Adams were here today, they'd be appalled at what's happening in the White House, at what's happening in Congress, at what's happening at the FBI, in the CIA. Noonan says here, almost immediately on receiving the Starr report, Congress voted to release it in full so that the fullest details of his sins could be made public. So everything then was out there on display. They put it on the internet and so on. And the whole country had to go through it. And as I said, at the time, we produced that little booklet, Character in Crisis. I think it came out in 1999, if I'm not mistaken. The first version. We've had more recent printings, of course. But in that booklet, my father and I are writing about all of these founders, like George Washington, who said that the foundation of our national policy will be laid in the pure and immutable principles of private morality. That's the foundation of the country. That's the foundation of the national policy. It's what we do, the principles of private morality. That's what counts. And Washington, as we were reminded in this McCullough biography, and as is printed there in the Character in Crisis booklet, he was giving his oath of office back in 1789. And then at the end said, "So help me God." He added that to the oath, and then bowed down and kissed the Bible. He added that. That's the foundation of America. That's the everything that they were doing was, as I was saying at book club last night, it was the first time through. And so they had the Declaration, they had the Constitution, but, well, what are my specific job responsibilities, thought the vice president, or this senator, or that representative in the House, or the cabinet for Washington? Okay, what are my responsibilities as far as this position is concerned? They were doing it all for the first time. And here are these founding fathers saying that what we do privately, this is the foundation of the nation itself. Washington, during his famous farewell in 1796, he said, "Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports." What would they say today? I had a story the other day. I didn't bring it with me, but I didn't have time to get to it the other day. All of these churches that are emptying out in the United States, we're supposed to be the religious nation, and yet you look at what we're churning out all over the world from Hollywood, pornography, and so on. And there are a lot of churches, but they're finding that even those churches are being sold off to be game centers or whatever else, because they can't fill them up. They don't have the funding anymore. Some pretty big churches in and around Edmond. They're in the heart of Oklahoma. I don't know if it's happening as much there, but it was something like 6,000 to 10,000 churches are being emptied out and sold off every year. Not so religious anymore, are we? Religion and morality. Well, you can go through that Character in Crisis booklet and see all the other statements from John Adams, from the other founding fathers. My father said in the booklet, "Today, Americans have departed from the ideals of our forefathers. We reason that religion and morality are nice, but certainly not necessary for the overall well-being of the nation. We have been led to falsely assume that private morality and public duty are separate issues. George Washington would have been appalled by such reasoning." He wouldn't have accepted that kind of reasoning. Private morality and public duty, they're completely separate? They aren't separate. God says so. And in the booklet, my father goes into what God says and how angry he is at our behavior, at what we're doing. He looks at us, his assessment, just like I covered in a program we taped yesterday for TV, his assessment, it's there in Galatians 1 in verse 4. He looks at our world, he looks at our nation and says it's evil. Isaiah 1 and 3, those chapters are even more precise. God compares our nations, the world at large, everybody has their problems. But he says about our nations that we've gone the way of Sodom and Gomorrah. But, you know, one last point that I just want to make from that Character in Crisis booklet, there's a section in there, and again, this was written back in the late 1990s, so my father's quoting from sources there in 1998, 1999. In this case, it's a 1998 piece from the New York Times where he's referring to David Boren, who's the I don't know if he's still the president of the University of Oklahoma, but he used to be a senator. Then he went on to become the president of the University of Oklahoma. And he says that in teaching his freshman class, whatever the class it was, he would ask them, well, what do you think about this scandal or the fact that the president's lying about this or that? And almost across the board, their response, this was a paraphrase, their response is, well, all politicians are crooks. Very few of them tell the truth. Few of them are faithful to their spouses. So why not have one who's smart and knows how to get things done? And according to Boren, that's almost an exact quote of the way freshmen were thinking 20 years ago. Those freshmen are now middle-aged. What does the current freshman, the freshman of today, think about politics, about leaders in society? How much respect and reverence is there for the leaders? As my father said, well, he quotes actually Mr. Boren from that that article in 98, in times of crisis, times of hardship, a level of trust between the American people and their government, particularly their leader, is an essential element of what's needed in the country. In times of crisis, we're not even fully there yet. But what happens when the crises set in? Do you think there's a level of trust between the people of the nation and their leader? Well, it's pretty well evenly divided, split right in two. Half the country thinks it's great, the other half thinks it's miserable, and it's leading to a spectacular clash, an explosion of violence, and we have our own sins, our sins to blame. As the Character in Crisis booklet brings out, we're witnessing greatly accelerated degeneration in character. Many in America laugh at the scandals, but God isn't laughing. God isn't laughing. Now you look around and see what's happening, not just to the leaders of our nations. There's this report on U.S. life expectancy. It's dropping again. It has been for the last 3 or 4 years. And you know why? Mostly because of suicide and drug overdoses. People are dying young because of these kinds of tragedies. The drug overdose rate rose 9.6% compared to 2016. 9.6% last year, above 2016. And so for this reason, you factor in the suicides. Suicides climbed 3.7%. And so for this reason, you're seeing the life expectancy is heading in the wrong direction. This Investor's Business Daily piece, it says here, it's been a given since America began industrializing in the mid-1800s that each generation would live longer than the one that came before. Since 2014, however, an alarming reversal has taken place, with life expectancy slipping each year. How can this be? How can this be? The last time we saw a drop like this was 100 years ago, the World War I era, when you had this Spanish flu epidemic, and of course the war itself claiming so many lives. But what is happening this time around? There's no flu epidemic that's killing people by the tens of thousands. There's no world war that we're involved in. It says, well, suicide rates have soared by 33% from 1999 to 2017. And then it talks about the drug overdoses as well. It says, why are so many, this is why I highlighted this piece in particular, because it focuses in on young people. These are the ones in many cases that are killing themselves, that are overdosing on drugs. It says, interestingly, as one might expect, the biggest increase in death rates came among the older millennial cohort from 25 to 34. So the young people, young adults. Why are so many young Americans, mostly male, and in the prime of their lives, engaging in such self-destructive behavior? Why are they? Why are they engaging in this kind of self-destructive behavior? Is it a lack of purpose for young people? A disengagement for all those still out of the workforce from the mainstream of life? Are young people tiring of the perpetual political polarization surrounding them in every social venue these days? Are America's sharp political divisions driving people to self-medicate and even kill themselves? Well, it offers a lot of questions, but no answers. It quotes this George Washington University expert as saying, "I really do believe that people are increasingly hopeless." Well, now we're on to something here. Hopelessness, which leads to drug use, which leads to suicide. Herbert Armstrong, he was talking about this back in 1981. He was talking about this more than 35 years ago in that last version of The Missing Dimension in Sex, speaking about human nature, the pull of human nature, constantly pulling on man in the direction of vanity and greed and self-love and competition and hostility and resentment and hatred. That's just the natural tendency. That's the natural direction we go. And it's so much stronger, that pull is, because of the influence of the devil who's been cast down to this earth. And he's the prince of the power of the air. He surcharges the air with his attitudes and impulses. And so if we're left our own devices to just do what comes naturally, well, naturally we go the way of self-love and competition and resentment and hatred. It's quite a pull. That's what we've got to resist against and come out of, the Bible teaches. Mr. Armstrong writes, this is on page 150 of The Missing Dimension in Sex. He says, why all this violence, this immorality? Here is the cause. Human nature, which is vanity without any purpose and absence of parental training and discipline. The causes of all these troubles that we're seeing all around us, human nature, he says, without any purpose, which is another way of saying hopelessness. There is no hope. There's no hope for so many of our young people, which is why the life expectancy rates are going down. This morning in Epistles of Paul class, we were going through 2 Corinthians 6 and 7. That last couple of verses in chapter 6, the Apostle Paul said, wherefore, come out from among them, and be you separate, says the Eternal, and touch not the unclean thing, and I will receive you. I will receive you. And then he continues the thought in verse 18 and says, and will be a father to you, and you shall be my sons and daughters, says the Eternal Almighty. It's conditional. You come out of this evil world and into my family. That's where hope resides. In the family of God. In the kingdom of God. In the government of God. Administering the family of God. Administering the government of God. Paul continues in the very next chapter. The next verse. Chapter 7 verse 1 says, having therefore these promises, dearly beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from all filthiness of the flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of God. Having these promises, because we have these promises, because we have this hope, then let us cleanse ourselves. Let us come out of the evil of this world. Think of 1 John 3 and verse 3, which says, and every man that has this hope in him purifies himself, even as he is pure. If you don't have the hope, then you're not going to purify yourself. That's what John was saying. These young people, so many of them, they don't have hope. That expert at the George Washington University, he's right. There's no hope. And so what are they resorting to? They're resorting to drugs and depression, alcohol, suicide, all kinds of godless behavior. And it's sad to see to see your nation. This sickness from within. There is a way out, though, but you have to make sure you're teaching young people the hope, giving them the hope. James 4 and verse 8 says, draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. The closer we get to God, the more hope we'll have and the more strength and power we'll have to cleanse ourselves from all impurities. Let us cleanse ourselves from all filthiness. Because we have these promises, as Paul said in 2 Corinthians 7, because we have them, dearly beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from all filthiness of the flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of God. When we come back, we'll wrap up this week of shows with another short study on the subject of God's love. Talk about a hopeful message. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. From the Philadelphia Church of God campus in Edstone, England, this is the Trumpet Daily Program with Stephen Fleury.
Over the last couple of weeks, I think we've had maybe two segments at the end of programs on the subject of love. If you remember, those of you who are regular listeners, we went through Philippians 2 about esteeming others better than yourself. That was, I believe, last week. And then earlier this week, we continued on with that, going through that chapter at the end of John's Gospel, John 21, where Jesus said to Peter, feed my sheep. He said, feed my lambs before that. And then we went into that that golden rule of doing unto others as you would have done to yourself. Let's continue along those same lines with 1 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 25. Here Paul is talking about the body of Christ and the many different members, the positions from top down, from the head all the way down to the toe. It says in 1 Corinthians 12 and verse 25 that there should be no schism or division in the body, but that the members should have the same care one for another. No schisms, no breaking off from the body, but all having the same care one for another. Here is a body, spiritually speaking, that is fitly joined together, as it says in Ephesians 4:16. Fitly joined together and compacted by that which every joint supplies. Every joint, every limb, every member thriving, alive with the Spirit of God. having the same care one for another. Verse 26 says, and whether one member suffer, all the members suffer with it, or one member be honored, all the members rejoice with it. If one member suffers, then all the other members are right there to comfort, to console. If another member's honored, then all the members share in that honor. That's the spirit of God's love. Paul says, now you are the body of Christ, and members in particular. You're the body of Christ. You're members of that one body. That's what we call the government chapter, the end of it, or toward the end of it. And it leads right into 1 Corinthians 13, what we often call the love chapter. I got an email a couple of years ago from one of our older members who mentioned that way back in 1947, when she was in the second grade in Tennessee, she had a teacher who had all of the second graders memorize the whole chapter of 1 Corinthians 13. This is 1947. It's quite a contrast with 1998 or 99 or 2018. We've really degenerated, as my father said, in character and crisis. This was a time where all the second graders in the school, in this classroom, they were not just reading 1 Corinthians 13, they memorized it. And as she said, it really impacted them. They memorized it, they said it together every morning before class. And this listener writes, I think it was a most wonderful way to teach little children how to get along and to work together without problems. What a good exercise that would be to have your children or an entire classroom commit that, if not the whole chapter, at least the definition of love, 1 Corinthians 13, 4 through 8. If you're going to memorize it, memorize the Moffat translation. Powerful words, inspiring words, and see if it doesn't help you as you go about your day. Just to start at the beginning, though, it says in verse 1 of this love chapter, though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not charity or love, God's love, agape love, that's the meaning there. It should say love in the King James. It does in other translations. But if I don't have that, Paul says, then I'm become as sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. Without love, I'm nothing. What is love? Herbert Armstrong defined it as an unselfish, outgoing concern for the good and welfare of the one loved. He said, love is primarily on the giving, serving, sharing side of the fence, not on the getting, taking, factional, striving side. It is not selfish. God's love is not selfish. It works no ill toward its neighbor, Romans 13:10. It fulfills the law of God, same verse. Without love, Paul talks some about gifts in 1 Corinthians 12, 1 Corinthians 13, and the brethren at Corinth were quite interested in a number of other gifts, but they weren't loving each other the way that they should have been. And so Paul comes along and says, look, without love, all those other gifts are useless. If it's not motivated by love, what good is it? Verse 2, and though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains and have not love, I am nothing. Some of the brethren there, they thought they had a lot of knowledge, but they weren't loving each other, not like they should have been. He continues, verse 3, and though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned and have not charity, it profits me nothing. You could make great sacrifices, just looking at it on the surface, physically, with your time or whatever, but if it's not motivated by God's love, is it really going to help the body of Christ? Is it really going to help the work of God? And then here's the definition. I'll read it in Moffat, verses 8 through 4 through 8. Paul says, love is very patient, very kind. Love knows no jealousy. Love makes no parade. It gives itself no airs, is never rude, never selfish, never irritated, never resentful. Love is never glad when others go wrong. Love is gladdened by goodness, always slow to expose, always eager to believe the best, always hopeful, always patient. Love never disappears. It never disappears. God's love doesn't. We talked the other day about the love that endures. Matthew 24, verses, 11 and 12 or 13, somewhere in there. The love of many waxed cold. We need the love that endures. God's love does that. That's why we need it. That's why we have to go to God for it. It doesn't come from us. We can't work it up from inside. We have to go to another source, a source from above, and fill up on it every day. The love of God, it suffers long, is so patient, it's so incredibly patient, so willing to forgive. Be patient, James wrote, unto the coming of the Lord. It says, behold, the husbandman wait for the precious fruit of the earth and has long patience. Are you willing to wait on God, to patiently wait on these edible fruits that he'll bring forth over time? If we'll stay the course, if we're willing to continue with this kind of love, you will be. Long patience, James said. This kind of love, God's love, is also very kind. It's very patient and it's very kind. It's kind. It's considerate, it's gentle, it's compassionate. It's the love that thinks about others. It's the love that learns to think about others. It envies not, Moffat says, knows no jealousy. It doesn't get angry in a split second with jealous envy motivating that anger. It's not inclined to be boastful either. It says, love vaunts not itself. It's not always talking about itself. It's not always out there on parade or parading his own accomplishments. We have to be motivated. We have to perform good works. And if we're motivated by God's love, there will be a trail of good works wherever it is that we go, but that's all right. That's not something to get vain about, because ultimately God gets the credit for that as well. All those works, all those fruits, the Spirit comes from God. The love comes from God. And so we don't get puffed up. Love is not puffed up, it says in the King James. It's not going around giving itself all the credit. It gives God the credit. It doesn't behave itself unseemly. That means it's never rude. It's not unmannerly. It doesn't act in an unbecoming way or disgracefully or indecently. There's good manners. There's good conduct. God's love doesn't seek its own. It's never selfish, Moffat says. It's an unselfish, outgoing concern. That doesn't mean you're not pursuing talents and abilities, developing a skill, and really becoming a professional about it. But it doesn't pursue those things out of a selfish motivation. It's not easily provoked. It's not always going around thinking evil about others. It gives the benefit of the doubt to others. It's not quick to let racial prejudices or class distinctions or status or any of those things divide us. Satan is the accuser of brethren. Satan is the author of division. Satan is the author of racial prejudice. God's love, it says, rejoices not in iniquity. In other words, it doesn't rejoice at the injustice that we see so many go through. It rejoices in truth. It rejoices in what's true and right. It bears all things. That means it's slow to expose. Sometimes it's necessary to expose something. God's love doesn't just cover up sin. It's not just tolerating sin. You have to confront it, and you have to get it out if it's not repented of. This doesn't mean we become a party to evil, this definition of love. But slow to expose. There's a difference. It believes all things. In other words, it's eager to believe the best. It's always hopeful. It endures all things. True love, God's love, never fails. It never fails. Paul begins and ends this definition of godly love by emphasizing patience, by emphasizing the fact that this is love that endures. It doesn't wax cold. It doesn't fade away. It doesn't disappear. That's not something that we can develop ourselves. We need to draw near to God, like James said. And then he'll fill us. He'll fill us with his Spirit. He'll fill us with this kind of love. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're putting the finishing touches on another day, another broadcast, another week of broadcasts here on KPCG and KPCG.fm. Thank you for joining us today and all week, and we'll see you next week.